We came down with the intention of meeting five people who were in New Orleans before, during, and after Katrina to hear about their memories of this storm, but more than that, kind of what had happened in their lives since, how the storm had transformed their lives, and also what else has happened in their lives in the past decade.
One of the people that you interview is a local teacher at Dillard University, Terry Coleman, and she kind of expressed this thing that I hear a lot around the city, a reticence or kind of an exhaustion from media coverage. I just wanted to play a little clip from how she expressed that.
I'm really, really hesitant about outsiders shaping memory.
Terry was one of the first people I met during our visit, and I really appreciated what she was saying, which was, you know, first, you got to appreciate that you're not from here, you haven't lived this, and you're coming and asking people to tell stories of people who have been living this for 10 years. And another thing she said is the 10-year anniversary is an opportunity for journalists from all over the country to write these think pieces about what has happened and how we should remember Katrina. And she said, look, I can't forget Katrina. Katrina is just part of life.
Tell me a little bit about visiting the coroner's office. How did you decide to look up Jeffrey Rouse, and what did you find there?
So I think somebody who was from New Orleans told us, well, this is interesting. We have a new coroner, the first new coroner in 40 years. And so his story of breaking back into the city to set up an emergency health clinic in the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel during Katrina was something I wanted to know more about. Well, I loved that interview. I learned a lot about his office, about the ways that he engages with the public, the ways that he is inviting more and more people in to witness autopsies when there's conflicting stories about what may have caused death, particularly in cases involving police. And one of the detail that I really loved that he kind of added at the very end of our interview was that a new thing he does is with every death certificate he signs, he also sends a condolence note.
Yeah.
To the family.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. That stuck with me.
Yeah, it just says so much about appreciating the sense of community in Orleans Parish, the parish that he serves.
It's a death, not just of the person who expired, but it's a slight death of the soul of this city. And I take that to heart.
He really does feel this kind of fabric of this city, and the way that he says, like, that he takes it personally, it's a death to the soul of the city that we all love together. I thought that was really beautifully said and quite sad.
So you head out to Gentilly to sit on a porch with Big Frida. You guys were great in kind of leaving in this scene where you sit on a porch swing, was it?
Uh-huh.
And you hear it creak.
Crack.
Crack. I just had this image that she was in her PJs or something, you know, like you guys were.
Oh, no, she
out,
was
having,
dressed.
Having morning coffee.
No,
yeah.
No,
what was she
dressed.
Wearing?
She was wearing head-to-toe denim, kind of a cut-off sleeves, button-down denim shirt, and kind of ripped denim jeans, and these, like, great sneakers, and her hair was really long, and she kept kind of sweeping it back from around her neck and had these fantastic fingernails.
One of the scenes that she conjures that was interesting to me is escaping from her neighborhood, which is flooding, with her family. At the convention center, people were really, as she described it, kind of reduced to basic instincts. And I just wanted to play a clip of what she was dealing with as she was kind of thrown in that mix.
I haven't grew a full beard, like full face. Hair was,
you couldn't shave, or just that it wasn't a priority?
I couldn't shave.
Are you comfortable when you have a beard growing?
Oh, no, honey. I've had baby smooth face since I was a baby, so I do not like when I have hair in my face. It irks me and it drives me. Like, no, it gotta feel smooth.
That detail about not being able to shave was just such a, you know, kind of concrete detail about the indignity of that time in her life. She's someone who likes to look good, doesn't feel comfortable with a beard, and just couldn't shave. And it's not the same as, you know, a life-threatening situation, but it said a lot to me about just the accumulated indignities of that time.
Simone Bruni, who people know better as Demolition Diva, she's somebody who kind of comes out of this experience and really finds herself in a way, or finds kind of a new trajectory for herself. Tell me a little bit about her. How did you wind up talking to her, and What stayed with you about your conversation?
We actually met Simone Bruni while we were down in the city. She kept coming up. People were saying, you know, oh, that's the Demo Diva's dumpster. See the hot pink dumpster? That's the Demo Diva. And we're like, who is this Demo Diva? So we reached out to her, asked her if she'd want to talk to us. And what I really liked about her story is before the storm, she describes like going to the preseason Saints game that the Friday night before Katrina hit. She was working in hospitality, had been sort of marketing to big corporate events in New Orleans, had been doing that work for 10 years. And then Katrina hits. She loses her job. She's a single woman and has to figure out what to do. Demo Diva, the company, started by being out and helping church groups and aid groups kind of navigate the city and seeing, you know, that there was a market for a demolition company that was marketing itself.
I remember going through a McDonald's, and I was going through the drive-thru, and there was a young girl that said, "Are you the Demo Diva?" And it was the first time that I had been addressed in that as a persona. And I said, yeah. And she said to me, "You go, girl."
Which is such a New Orleans kind of compliment, you know?
I love that because she's like, oh my goodness, not only do I have a company, I'm this persona. She really kind of now fully, you know, she is the Demo Diva.
You also spoke to a doctor who's a transplant, Kirsta Kurtz-Burke. She was at Charity Hospital trying to keep her patients and the nurses working with her together and waiting for help. And that was quite a moment she conjured. And now that she's on the other end, thinking again about, well, kind of where are we at? What did that mean?
What's hard living here is we want to have this end to the story. We want to have the 10 years be a closure. Is New Orleans better than ever? Is it a gentrified hipster paradise? Or is it a, you know, sinking hellhole? And the reality is there's just no short answer. There's no period on the end of the sentence yet.
The question of like, where are we going? We don't really know yet. We know things are shifting. We know things are changing. We know they're not in the state of emergency that they were 10 years ago. But what that all is building and how to sum it up, she wasn't ready to do that. And I really appreciated that. The other thing that she said that I thought she said really beautifully was, she said, look, this is an insane place to live. This is an insane place to decide to put down roots. But she and her husband, who are both from the Midwest, she said, we just kind of realized that we'd gotten too weird to live anywhere else. So she's at once kind of saying, like, it doesn't make any sense, but this is where we belong.
Anna Sale is based in New York City and is the creator and host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money from NPR member station WNYC. Thanks so much, Anna.
Thank you, Jesse.